do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
Your enemy is ruling your country, and war is what they got.
We were afraid of revolution.
Americans are concerned.
Why we are afraid of revolution.
About the adjustments.
Why we are afraid of revolution. Black man,
that are taking place in our financial markets.
Black man, come here to fight liberation.
There was blood on the floor at the end of trading on Wall Street today.
A financial tsunami.
One of the ugliest days I have ever seen.
Time for we have a revolution. Man said a time for we have a revolution.
Here on Wall Street.
The atomic bomb.
Almost Armageddon.
A 9 on the Richter scale.
Something of a financial hurricane hitting the United States today.
There's been a class war waged in America for 30 years now, from the top down. And the rich have won.
The war is going well enough that there's no need to end it. And just as importantly, it's not going well enough that there's any possibility of ever ending
it. Those who threaten Israel threaten us.
These are revolutionary times.
I prescribe the treatment of a radical revolution within our nation from that of a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented community.
So the paradox is that people are working harder, but still falling behind.
We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, on all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Even a worker in the lowest paying position has a right to get by and support a family with a good union job.
Bolshevism, sheer Bolshevism.
For the past 30 years, the productivity of American workers has increased by 76%. But their real hourly wages have risen less than 2%.
I ask Congress to appropriate additional money to protect corporate America and to punish American workers. And we're making good progress.
So the paradox is that people are working harder and still falling behind.
I will ensure that Israel can defend itself from any threat, from Gaza to Tehran.
Is anybody buying this polished turd?
A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us.
Welcome to Seeing Red Radio, an experiment in radical grassroots media. Radio with a revolutionary socialist perspective. I am your host, Anthony Udell. Welcome. I have a guest here. Don is sitting in with us this show. Don, you're regularly a host on Farm to Fork? There we go. I got you now. Yeah, no, repeat that.
I'm our newest co-host on our local agricultural and food radio show.
Awesome.
Tuesdays alternating 6:30 to 7:30.
Sweet. Sweet. Good old Valley Free Radio. Community radio at its finest in the hallowed halls of the Florence Community Center. I like to consider this place like the loudest little room
in the loudest little town.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. we get heard all over the place, but I've had this crazy experience in that after 3 years of being on Valley Free Radio, I finally decided I'd podcast my show, and
you know, I think people can vote for you on iTunes.
Well, oh, and they can't. Yeah. And you can't do anything about them. But, you know, I have a website, and I welcome all comments, all comers, by all means, come on down. But, you know, the folks, you know, I can moderate those if they're really, really nasty. But, you know, the stuff that iTunes, that they can put up on iTunes. And but I suppose if I didn't get a lot of negative responses for the kind of show that I do, I wouldn't be doing my job right. I mean, clearly, you know, you do a show about revolutionary socialism, you know. If everyone's, oh, these guys are great, you know. Anyway, but I've also gotten some really great responses, so I can't complain. But on this evening's show, I'd like to talk about David Harvey, the distinguished professor at the City University of New York. Has a fantastic website at davidharvey.org. He has been teaching Karl Marx's Capital for over 40 years, and for practically at least once a year, from what I understand. And he has put up his entire course, all 13 classes. And thank God, because had he not done that, I would never have finally finished that book. I've tried that book, you know, 20 times. Yeah, I call myself a socialist, and it's like, capital. I want to get to the top of that mountain. And thank you, David Harvey, for getting me there. He has written a great article on the stimulus plan, on the fate of contemporary Keynesian economics, on superpower dominance in 2025. Yeah, fact-filled, a lot of stuff. And so we're going to definitely feature that. And of course, at the very end of the program, I would like to discuss, to respond to a particular negative comment that I got on the website. You know, not that I think that the person who actually wrote this negative comment is actually listening.
The Republicans have to do something since they're out of power, right?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So they find my site and they say, you know, socialism, you know, that's giving money over to the do-nothing. So I'm going to respond a little bit over to that. Let's take a little quick break with some last poets, and then we're going to jump into some David Harvey. Stay tuned to Seeing Red Radio.
Nuts, bolts, screws, I got the blues from paying dues, from programmed news, of honey-coated lies. Your eyes can't believe that weave the devil's magic with the latest gadget from the mean machine. Are running the same game with another name. Down in your brain, blowing your mind. Stealing your time, smooth and slick, with the latest trick to get rich quick from nonsense at your mind's expense. As your mind digs the scene from the mean machine designed to drive your brain insane. Loud speakers blasting inside your head, saying what someone else said, for you to do what they want you to. No, go fast, slow, getting you high off the latest lie, telling you when, where, how, and why. As your mind digs the scene from the mean machine, are running the same game with another name. Factories of insanity playing on your vanity as they distort your sense of self, telling you what you need and how to succeed as they steal all of your wealth. Probing your mind, trying to find how to scheme on you best, from program schools with devilish rules putting you through the test. Death-dealing devices sold at high prices, designed with you in mind to buy, as they kill you slow, and some of y'all don't even know, y'all paying the machine to die. Mechanized lies, dressed up in disguise, in forms of various kinds, treachery and deceit, the people must defeat in the battle for free men's minds. For complete domination is the goal of this nation, of all free-thinking thought, and those who oppose will be killed by their foes, the flunkies whose souls have been bought. Transplants to revive the living dead, replacing the truth with lies instead. Newspapers, radios, TVs, spreading lies across the seven seas. Robot men with computers and brains, spaceships, cars, trains, and planes, all calculated to blow your mind, moving faster than your sense of time. Living luxuriously soft while the people slave hard, for the devil would have you believe he is God. Chemical drugs that keep you high, while a mean machine creates another lie for power, glory, and worldwide fame, while running the same game with another name. It's the computer's equation for worldwide invasion, and it comes in the name of peace and goodwill. All of them are lying as they keep on trying to set the people up for the kill. Population control of the people with soul all over the planet Earth, manipulating their will with a tiny white pill to control their natural birth. Behind the scenes schemes, furthering the mean machine's dreams of conquest and world domination, from the farthest depths of the universe to the smallest earthly nation. Radar, sonar, laser beams, jets, tanks, submarines, megathon, H-bomb, napalm, gas! All this shit will kill you fast. All products of the mean machine, the devil disguised as a human being. And he will even preach that God.
Last poets right here on Seeing Red Radio. In November of 2008, shortly after the election of a new president, the National Intelligence Council of the United States issued its Delphic estimates on what the world would be like in 2025. Perhaps for the first time, a quasi-official body in the United States predicted that by 2025, the United States, while still a powerful, if not the most powerful single player in world affairs, would no longer be dominant. The world would be multipolar, and less centered, and the power of non-state actors would increase. The report conceded that U.S. hegemony had been fading on and off for some time, but that its economic, political, and even military dominance was now systematically waning. Above all, and it is important to note that the report was prepared before the implosion of the U.S. and British financial systems, quote, the unprecedented shift in relative wealth and economic power, roughly from west to east, now underway, will continue, end quote. This unprecedented shift has reversed the long-standing drain of wealth from east, southeast, and South Asia to Europe and North America that had been occurring since the 18th century, a drain that even Adam Smith had noted with regret in The Wealth of Nations, but which accelerated relentlessly throughout the 19th century. The rise of Japan in the 1960s, followed by South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong in the 1970s, and then the rapid growth of China after 1980, later accompanied by industrialization spurts in Indonesia, India, Vietnam, Thailand, and Malaysia during the 1990s, has altered the center of gravity of capitalist development. Although it has not done so smoothly, the East and Southeast Asian financial crisis of 97-98 saw wealth flow briefly but strongly back towards Wall Street and the European and Japanese banks. Economic hegemony seems to be moving towards some constellation of powers in East Asia, and if crises, as we earlier argued, are moments of radical reconfigurations in capitalist development, then the fact that the United States is having to deficit finance its way out of its financial difficulties on such a huge scale, and that the deficits are largely being covered by those countries with saved surpluses, Japan, China, South Korea, Taiwan, and the Gulf states, suggests this may be the moment for such a shift to be consolidated. Shifts of this sort have occurred before in the long history of capitalism. In Giovanni Arrighi's thorough account in the long 20th century, we see hegemony shifting from the city-states of Genoa and Venice in the 16th century to Amsterdam and the Low Countries in the 17th, before concentrating in Britain from late 18th century until the United States eventually took control after 1945. There are a number of features to these transitions that Arrighi emphasizes and which are relevant to our analysis. Each shift, Arrighi notes, occurred in the wake of a strong phase of financialization. He cites with approval Braudel's maxim that financialization announces the autumn of some hegemonic configuration. But each shift also entailed a radical change of scale, from small city-states at the origin to the continent-wide economy of the United States in the latter half of the 20th century. This change of scale makes sense given the capitalist rule of endless accumulation and compound growth of at least 3% forever. But hegemonic shifts, Arrighi argues, are not determined in advance. They depend upon the emergence of some power economically able and politically and militarily willing to take on the role of global hegemon, with its costs as well as its advantages. The reluctance of the United States to assume that role before World War II meant an interregnum of multipolar tensions that could not halt the drift into war. Britain was no longer in a position to assert its prior hegemonic role. Much also depends on how the past hegemon behaves as it faces up to the diminution of its former role. It can pass peaceably or belligerently into history. From this perspective, the fact that the United States still holds overwhelming military power, particularly from 30,000 feet up, in a context of its declining economic and financial power, an increasingly shaky cultural and moral authority, creates worrying scenarios for any future transition. Furthermore, it is not obvious that the main candidate to displace the United States, China, has the capacity or the will to assert some hegemonic role. For while its population is certainly huge enough to meet the requirements of changing scale, neither its economy, nor its political authority, or even its political will point to an easy ascension to the role of global hegemon. Given the nationalist divisions that exist, the idea that some association of East Asian powers might do the job, BRIC powers, Brazil, Russia, India, and China to stay on a common path for long, For this reason, the prediction that we are headed into another interregnum of multipolar and conflictual interests and potential global instability appears implausible. We'll be right back with David Harvey. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back after this.
All these issues connected with class and class conflict in America and class struggle in America. And yes, we've had movies in which deal with working class people, but it's always some individual person, the working class, who rises up out of his or her situation individually and makes it in American society. But the stories of Americans who organize and get together along class lines to oppose the powers that hold them down, that has been very, very rare. You do not see films about the struggles of the textile girls, the girls who went to work in the textile mills of Massachusetts, of Lowell and Lawrence, who went in the spans a long history from the early 19th century, from the 1830s. It's a marvelous story there about the Lowell girls of the 1830s who organized and went on strike. And you will not see films about what they did, and you'll not see films about this rich history of labor struggles that took place in the United States. Because after all, the American system set up by the Constitution and the American political system and the Constitution of the United States, so revered and so celebrated, did not grant any economic rights to the American people. Did not grant the, we very often forget that the Constitution gives political rights but not economic rights. It gives, and even those political rights are circumscribed by the loss and the non-existence of economic rights. Because if you're not wealthy, your political rights are limited, even though they exist on paper in the Constitution. But freedom of speech is something that exists there. Yes, you have a political right to free speech, but how much free speech you have depends on how much money you have and what access to resources you have. But as far as economic rights, none of them in the Constitution. Here's the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And how can you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness if you don't have the right to food, to housing, to health care? And so working people all through American history have had to organize and struggle, go on strike, declare boycotts, face the police and the army and the National Guard, and some of those violent and dramatic scenes, they had to do it themselves in order to win the 8-hour day, in order to somewhat change their working conditions.
The great historian. It's quite the store of collective knowledge about resistance in the United States. Speaking about class, we return now to David Harvey. The tectonic shift away from the United States dominance and hegemony that has been underway for some time is becoming much clearer. The thesis of both excessive financialization and debt as a principal predictor of leading world powers' debilitation has found popular voice in the writings of Kevin Phillips. Attempts now underway to rebuild U.S. dominance through reforms in the architecture of both the national and global state finance nexus appears not to be working, while the exclusions imposed on most of the rest of the world is in seeking to reshape that architecture are almost certain to provoke strong oppositions, if not overt, economic conflicts. But tectonic shifts of this sort do not come about as if by magic. While the historical geography of a shifting hegemony, as Arrighi describes,
It has a clear pattern, and while it is also clear from the historical record that periods of financialization precede such shifts, Arrighi does not provide any deep analysis of the processes that produce such shifts in the first place. To be sure, he cites endless accumulation, and therefore the growth syndrome, the 3% compound growth rule, which essentially has characterized capitalism since genesis of industrial capitalism around 1750, 1780, as a critical rule to explaining the shifts. This implies that hegemony moves from smaller, i.e. Venice, to larger, for example, the United States, political entities over time. And it also stands to reason that hegemony has to lie with that political entity within which much of the surplus is produced, or to which much of the surplus flows in the form of tribute or imperialist extractions. With total global output standing at $45 trillion as of 2005, the U.S. share of $15 trillion made it, as it were, the dominant and controlling shareholder in global capitalism, able to dictate, as it typically does in its role as the chief shareholder in the international institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF, global policies. The NGIS report in part based its prediction on loss of dominance, but maintenance of a strong position on the failing share of global output in the U.S. relative to the rest of the world in general, and in China in particular. But as Arrighi points out, the politics of such a shift are by no means certain. The United States' bid for global hegemony under Woodrow Wilson during and immediately after World War I was thwarted by a domestic political preference in the United States for isolationism, hence the collapse of the League of Nations. And it was only after World War II, which the U.S. population was against entering until Pearl Harbor occurred, that the U.S. embraced its role as global hegemon through a bipartisan foreign policy anchored by the Bretton Woods agreements on how the post-war international order would be organized in the face of the Cold War and the spreading threat to capitalism of international communism. That the United States had long been developing into a state that in principle could play the role of global hegemon is evident from relatively early days. It possessed relative doctrines such as manifest destiny, you know, the continental-wide geographical expansion acquisitions, or the Monroe Doctrine, which warned European powers to leave the Americans alone. The doctrine was almost formulated by the British Foreign Secretary Canning in the 1820s, but adopted by the U.S. as its own almost immediately. The United States possessed the necessary dynamism to account for a growing share of global output, and was quintessentially committed to some version of what can best be called cornered market or monopoly capitalism, backed by an ideology of rugged individualism. So there is a sense in which the U.S. was, throughout much of its history, preparing itself to take on the role of global hegemon. The only surprise was that it took so long to do so, and that it was the second rather than the first world war that led it finally to take up the role, leaving the interwar years as years of multipolarity and chaotic, competing imperial ambitions of the sort that the NCIS report fears will be the situation in 2025. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back after this.
The people's flag is deepest red, it's shrouded off the mass of dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying near. It waved above our infant night when all our heads seemed dark as night. It witnessed many a deed and vow, we mustn't change its color now. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumphs past, it gives the hope of peace at last. The banner bright, the symbol plain of human rights and human gain. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live or die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying near. Yeah.
his mind's a fixed on health and place. To cringe beneath the rich man's frown and haul that sacred emblem down.
Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its falls we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. With heads uncovered, swear we all to bear it on board till we fall. Come dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song shall be our parting hymn. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Billy Bragg on Seeing Red Radio with Red Flag. The tectonic shifts now underway are deeply influenced, however, by the radical geographical unevenness in the economic and political possibilities of responding to the current crisis. Let me illustrate how this unevenness is now working by way of a tangible example. As the depression that began in 2007 deepened, the argument was made by many that a full-fledged Keynesian solution was required to extract global capitalism from the mess that it was in. To this end, various stimulus packages and bank stabilization measures were proposed and to some degree taken up in different countries in different ways in the hope that these would resolve the difficulties. The variety of solutions on offer varied immensely depending on the economic circumstances and the prevailing forms of political opinion, pitting, for example, Germany against Britain and France in the European Union. Consider, however, the different economic political possibilities in the United States and China and the potential consequences for both shifting hegemony and for the manner in which the crisis might be resolved. In the United States, any attempt to find an adequate Keynesian solution has been doomed at the start by a number of economic and political barriers that are almost impossible to overcome. A Keynesian solution would require massive and prolonged deficit financing if it were to succeed. It has been correctly argued Roosevelt's attempt to return to a balanced budget in 1937-38 plunged the United States back into a depression and that it was therefore World War II that saved the situation and not Roosevelt's too timid approach to deficit financing in the New Deal. So even if the institutional reforms as well as the push towards a more egalitarian policy did lay the foundations for the post-World War II recovery, the New Deal in itself actually failed to resolve the crisis in the United States. The problem for the United States in 2008-2009 is that it starts from a position of chronic indebtedness to the rest of the world. It has been borrowing at the rate of more than $2 billion a day over the last 10 years or more. And this poses an economic limitation upon the size of the extra deficit that can now be incurred. This was not a serious problem for Roosevelt, who began with a roughly balanced budget. There is also a geopolitical limitation, since the funding of any extra deficit is contingent upon the willingness of other parties, principally from East Asia and Gulf states, to lend. On both counts, the economic stimulus available to the United States will almost certainly be neither large enough nor sustained enough to be up to the task of reflating the economy. The problem is exacerbated by ideological reluctance on the part of both political parties to embrace the huge amounts of deficit spending that will be required. Ironically, in part because the previous Republican administration worked on Dick Cheney's principle that, quote, Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter, end quote. As Paul Krugman, the leading public advocate for a Keynesian solution, for one, has argued, the $800 billion reluctantly voted on by Congress in 2009, while better than nothing, is nowhere near enough. It may take something on the order of $2 trillion to do the job, and that is indeed excessive debt relative to where the U.S. deficit now stands. The only possible economic option would be to replace the weak Keynesianism of excessive military expenditures by much stronger Keynesianism of social programs, cutting the U.S. defense budget in half, bringing it more in line with that of Europe in relation to the proportion of GDP. Might technically help, but it would be, of course, political suicide, given the posture of the Republican Party, as well as many Democrats, for anyone who proposed it. The second barrier is more purely political. In order to work, the stimulus has to be administered in such a way as to guarantee that it will be spent on goods and services, and so get the economy humming again. This means that any relief must be directed to those who will spend it, which means the lower classes. Since even the middle classes, if they spend it at all, are more likely to spend it on bidding up asset values, like buying up foreclosed homes, for example, rather than increasing their purchases of goods and services. In any case, when times are bad, many people will tend to use any extra income they receive to retire debt or to save, as largely happened when the $600 tax rebate designed by the Bush administration in the early summer of 2008. What appears prudent and rational from the standpoint of the household bodes ill for the economy at large. In much the same way that the banks have rationally taken public money and either hoarded it or used it to buy assets rather than to lend, the prevailing hostility in the United States to spreading the wealth around and to administering any sort of relief other than tax cuts to individuals arises out of hardcore neoliberal ideological doctrine centered in, but by no means confined to the Republican Party, that households know best. These doctrines have broadly been accepted as gospel by the American public at large after more than 30 years of neoliberal political indoctrination. There is a tacit acceptance, for example, that wage repression, a key component to the present system, is a normal state of affairs in the United States. One of the three legs of a Keynesian solution, greater empowerment of labor, rising wages, and redistribution towards the lower classes, is politically impossible in the United States at this point in time. The very charge that some such program amounts to socialism sends shivers of terror through the political establishment. Labor is not strong enough after 30 years of being battered by political forces, and no broad social movement is in sight that will force redistributions toward the working classes. One other way to achieve Keynesian goals is to provide collective goods. This has traditionally entailed investments in both physical and social infrastructure. You know, the WPA programs of the 1930s is a forerunner. Hence the attempts to insert into the stimulus package programs to rebuild and extend physical infrastructures for transport, communications, power, and other public works, along with increasing expenditures on healthcare, education, municipal services, and the like. These collective goods do have the potential to generate multipliers for employment as well as for the effective demand for further goods and services. But the presumption is that these collective goods are at some point going to belong to the category of productive state expenditures, i.e., stimulate further growth, rather than become a series of public white elephants, which, as Keynes long ago remarked, amounted to nothing more than putting people to work digging ditches and filling them in again. In other words, an infrastructural investment strategy has to be targeted towards systematic revival of 3% growth through, for example, systematic redesign of our urban infrastructures and ways of life. This will not work without sophisticated state planning plus an existing productive base that can take advantage of the new infrastructural configurations. Here, too, the long prior history of deindustrialization in the United States and the intense ideological opposition to state planning, elements of which were incorporated into Roosevelt's New Deal and which continued into the 1960s, only to be abandoned in the face of the neoliberal assault upon that particular exercise of state power in the 1980s, and the obvious preference for tax cuts rather than infrastructural transformations, makes the pursuit of a full-fledged Keynesian solution all but impossible in the United States. Right now we're listening to an article written by David Harvey, distinguished professor of the City University of New York. We're discussing the current proposed, well, recently just actually passed the Senate, thanks to three Republican votes that made it filibuster-proof, the $800 billion stimulus package. David Harvey is also discussing the proposition of American superpower dominance in 2025. We'll return to that discussion in just a moment. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Jeffrey. the late, great Dennis Brown with Revolution right here on Seeing Red Radio. We'll continue here with David Harvey discussing China and the possibility of China recovering their economy with a truly Keynesian solution. Now, of course, what we mean by Keynesianism is we're talking about trying to get the get ourselves out of the mess we're in by spend, let the government go ahead and basically print the cash and employ the folks. And, of course, as we all hope, it's, again, for useful infrastructure, which we all need, as opposed to, the bridge to nowhere. But back to David Harvey. In China, on the other hand, both the economic and political conditions exist where a full-fledged Keynesian solution would indeed be possible, and where there are abundant signs that this path will likely be followed. To begin with, China has a vast reservoir of foreign cash surplus, and it is easier to debt finance on that basis than it is with a vast, already existing debt overhang, as is in the case presently with the United States. It is also worth noting that ever since the mid-1990s, the toxic assets, the non-performing loans of the Chinese banks, some estimates put them as high as 40% of all loans in 2000, have been wiped off the bank's books by occasional infusions of surplus cash from the foreign exchange reserves. The Chinese have had a long-running equivalent of the TARP program in the United States and evidently know how to do it, even if many of the transactions are tainted by corruption. The Chinese have the economic wherewithal to engage in a massive deficit finance program and have a centralized state financial architecture to administer that program effectively, if they care to use it. The banks, which were long state-owned, may have been nominally privatized to satisfy the WTO requirements and to lure in foreign capital and expertise, but they can still easily be bent to central state will, whereas in the United States, even the vaguest hint of state direction, let alone nationalization, creates a political furor. There is likewise absolutely no ideological barrier to redistributing economic largesse to the neediest sectors of society, though there may be some vested interests of wealthier party members in China and an emergent capital class to be overcome. The charge that this would amount to socialism, or even worse, God forbid, communism in China, would simply be greeted with amusement. But in China, the emergence of mass unemployment, at the last report there were thought to be some 20 million unemployed as a result of the slowdown, and signs of widespread, rapidly escalating social unrest, will almost certainly push the Communist Party to massive redistributions, whether they are ideologically concerned to do so or not. As of early 2009, this seemed to be directed in the first interest to revitalizing the lagging rural areas to which many unemployed migrant workers have returned in frustration at the loss of jobs in manufacturing areas. In these regions where both social and physical infrastructures are lagging, a strong infusion of central government support will raise incomes, expand effective demand, and begin upon the long process of consolidation of China's internal market. There is, secondly, a strong predilection to undertake the massive infrastructural investments that are still lagging in China, whereas tax reductions have almost no political appeal. While some of these may turn into white elephants, the likelihood is far less, since there is still an immense amount of work to be done to integrate the Chinese national space. And so, to confront the problem of uneven geographical development between the coastal regions of high development and the impoverished interior provinces. The existence of an extensive, though troubled, industrial and manufacturing base in need of special rationalization makes it more likely that the Chinese effort will fall into the category of productive state expenditures. For the Chinese, much of the surplus can be mopped up in the further production of space, even allowing for the fact that speculation in urban property markets in cities like Shanghai, as in the United States, is part of the problem and cannot therefore be part of the solution. Infrastructural expenditures, provided they are on a sufficiently large scale, will go a long way to both mopping up surplus labor and so reducing the possibility of social unrest and, again, boosting the internal market. These completely different opportunities to pursue a full-fledged Keynesian solution, as represented by the contrast between the United States and China, have profound international implications. If China uses more of its financial reserves to boost its internal market, as it is almost certainly bound to do for political reasons, so it will have less left over to lend to the United States,
Reduced purchases of U.S. Treasury bills will eventually force higher interest rates and impact U.S. internal demand negatively. And unless managed carefully, could trigger the one thing that everyone fears, but which has so far been staved off, a run on the dollar. A gradual move away from reliance on U.S. markets and the substitution of the internal market in China as a source of effective demand for Chinese industry will alter power balances significantly. And by the way, be stressful for both the Chinese and the United States. The Chinese currency will necessarily rise against the dollar, a move that the U.S. authorities have long sought but secretly feared, thus forcing the Chinese to rely even more on their internal market for aggregate demand. The dynamism that will result within China as opposed to their internal market, as opposed to the prolonged recession conditions that will prevail in the United States, will draw more and more global suppliers of raw materials into the Chinese trade orbit and lessen the relative significance of the United States in international trade. The overall effect will be to accelerate the drift of wealth from west to east in the global economy and rapidly alter the balance of hegemonic economic power. The tectonic movement in the balance of global capitalist power will intensify with all manner of unpredictable political and economic ramifications in a world where the United States will no longer be in a dominant position, even as it possesses significant power. The supreme irony, of course, is that the political and ideological barriers in the United States to any full-fledged Keynesian program will almost certainly hasten loss of U.S. dominance in global affairs. Even as the elites of the world, including those in China, would wish to preserve that dominance for as long as possible. Whether or not true Keynesianism in China, along with some other states in a similar position, will be sufficient to compensate for the inevitable failure of reluctant Keynesianism here in the United States is an open question. But the unevenness coupled with the fading U.S. hegemony may well be the precursor to a breakup of the global economy into regional hegemonic structures, which could just as easily fiercely compete with each other as collaborate on the miserable question of who is to bear the brunt of long-lasting depression. That is an article by David Harvey on the stimulus bill, the possibilities for Chinese global superpower dominance in 2025, and the state of contemporary Keynesianism. Let the government pay for it all. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We have a few moments. Stay tuned. A special comment on some of the negative responses I've been getting. You gotta love it. This time the bullet could rock ya. Yellow ribbon instead of a swastika. Nothing proper about your propaganda. Rules for the rules when the set commands ya. Said it was blue when the blood was red. That's how you got a bullet blasted through your head. Blasted through your head. Blasted through your head. A shout out to the living dead. Stood and watched as the feds grew centralized. Full serene on the screen, you was mesmerized. Cellular phone, sounding a death tone. Corporations called, turn you to stone before you realize. And all the clip in army color. Said they packed the nine. They fire it at prime time. The sleeping gas, every home was like out the trash. And motherfuckers lost their minds. Just victims of the in-house drive-by. Don't you say how high? Yeah. Just victims of the in-house drive-by. They say, don't you say how high? Run it! We'll be right back.
This was a comment that was posted on the seeingredradio.org website. How is capitalism robbery when socialism says we are all equal and must give what I earn to others who can't perform like I do? Socialism is robbery more so than capitalism. When I am successful, I get rewarded under capitalism. Under socialism, I would have to give it to the do-nothings. Don't mistake hits and subscribers to your podcast as fans. Most of us listen to make sure your thoughts and ideas are kept in check. Not that I imagine that the person who wrote this is actually listening at this moment in time, though he does point out that he will be keeping my thoughts and ideas in check. So Seeing Red Radio thought it would be a good idea if we presented a response to this negative comment to illustrate exactly what it is that we do mean when we speak of revolutionary socialism. First, it's unclear to what you refer when you declare socialism says we are all equal. The Declaration of Independence states that all men are created equal. This, of course, was stated at a time when Americans enslaved millions of Africans. On the other hand, Karl Marx wrote in his 1875 Critique of the Goethe Program, "From each according to his ability, to each according to his need," asserting that even in a socialist society, individuals are neither equal in their capacities nor in their necessary requirements to sustain and reproduce themselves. Later you state, "When I am successful, I get rewarded under capitalism," repeating the ancient perennial mantra of capitalist meritocracy that claims that hard work and perseverance engenders success, and that in turn brings a reward. Hard work and perseverance can only assuredly bring success in an economic system that gives you the full value of the wealth that you create, not the portion the capitalist deems you worthy of receiving, which under capitalism is your reward. This reward, as evidenced by the near stagnancy of real wages for American workers in the last 35 years and the mountains of household debt that these same workers have amassed, is very obviously barely enough to get by. An economic system in which those who produce the wealth of society are required to give of their toil a tribute to do-nothings is a system that cannot stand and must be abolished. It is for this reason that Seeing Red Radio is devoted to the abolition of capitalism. What is a dividend, for example, if not an entitlement to a portion of profit from a productive enterprise for which the receiving shareholder has contributed nothing? For example, the surviving clan of Jim Walton, founder of Walmart, whose descendants make up 4 of the 10 richest persons in the U.S., only one of them is actually involved in the company beyond their stakes as shareholders. You can't stretch the illusion of meritocratic success far enough to conceal nearly $100 billion of wealth redistribution from the sweat of Walmart employees who, on average, make less than $10 an hour, not to mention the Chinese factory workers who manufacture the vast majority of Walmart's products, who make on average less than $3 an hour in real wages, but in actual wages, make closer to 64 cents an hour. It would be surprising if the tens of millions of workers in the global economy who will lose their livelihoods in this most recent of capitalism's never-ending cycle of devastating crises are not hoping as well that their success at their jobs will bring them a compensatory reward. And yet these same workers, who actually travel to their jobs, clock in their time, and create the wealth, will soon be on the street. But the new nothing shareholder, who's not going to be worrying about where his next meal is going to be coming from, will invariably get a boost in his stock price when the news is announced of the latest mass layoffs. Brother, there are individuals in this world who need to be kept in check, but it is not me, nor you, nor the vast majority of the rest of humanity who is still waiting for their reward. It is time for us to reject the counterfeit ideas that apologists peddle to conceal capitalism's true identity. This is what they call the pot calling the kettle black. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Try to shake me.
And that's this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio. For links to articles or music that you heard, or if you'd like to support Seeing Red Radio, check out the website at seeingredradio.org. Peace, comrades. Check in next week.